Here we gather in a ring, here a garland fresh we fling. Flowers are we just blossoming, blossoming together.
We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Good folks, all a word with you, what a world to bring us to. We shall make the world anew, all of us together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. We are growing, but one day, all of us as one will say, none shall slave and none shall slay, all shall work together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Hand to hand, how far we reach, each for all and all for each. Thus we play and thus we teach, hearts and hands together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Now our clasping hands we raise, holding high a song of praise, song of hope for better days, all people linked together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. Forward stepping row by row, waves of freedom on we flow, singing, shining as we go, comrades all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together.
Tossed in two frozen chicken breasts, a little bit of dried black beans and a little bit of dried red beans.
Okay.
And a can of corn. And some green chili and the flavor packet. And then I'm going to let it cook for about an hour and then add a thing of tomatoes. The reason why I'm doing this later is that tomatoes are pretty acidic and can can interfere with beans cooking. So you don't want to start it, so you want to let the beans get a head start.
Okay.
And do it. And then I did slow cook start. And it's got a timer for 6 hours for slow cook.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. And then we can hit keep warm.
If nice.
If not quite ready to eat, then it'll just keep it hot enough that we won't food poison ourselves.
That's always good.
Totally
I hear.
Easy.
I hear.
I finished gathering up the boxes and cans. This is the condensed recycling.
Nice. Productive
actually,
of you.
They need to go into different bins there.
Sure, but these are the cardboard ones, and the rest of these are cans.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is if you dump all the cans into the box and then break those down, that'll make it so I don't have to do that when I get to Fort Collins.
Okay. Yeah, I can do that.
Well, the car's completely full right now, so this is going to go out into the Quonset hut.
Quonset hut! We will kick this recycling can down the road.
I saw what you did there.
Thank you.
I sort of want to take a picture of Gibran's amazing Lacroix collection.
Yeah, I prefer you didn't post it to Facebook.
Boop.
You want to memorialize it. That's
Here, I can help with the crushing.
Memorializing everything around here.
If you want to bring those over here, that would be fun.
Okie doke. Well, you're doing exactly what I would do, so I'll help you with it.
This is my specific system, is old mop.
Right.
It
was a pretty easily identifiable system.
Gotcha. So we should do a water level at one
point. I have to go to work in half an hour.
Okay.
I can fill them there.
All of them?
I mean, yeah. I can sit there. I probably won't fill these big ones.
The awkward ones.
Yeah. I don't even know how to fill them on the thing I have, so.
How refillable they really are.
I think they would be handy for like the current situation. Like we can use that water to heat up instead of using the drinking water. I can bring at least one and try and figure it out.
Do they have any, do you have any word of whether or not they're going to charge us, and if so, how much for fixing the pipes?
No, I mean, I now said to two Eagle employees, like, we don't want to have to, like, pay for this visit because you're not supposed to have done this. Mm-hmm. And neither one of them, like, so that's not going to work, so.
Keeping our expectations known, because yeah, we already did pay them half of the project that they haven't done.
That's the thing. Is that we paid for this, goddammit.
Yeah, so they should not try and put the onus on us and claim that they called us and no one didn't get to anybody. They could have called more than once for one.
Right, totally. And they could have called my number and been like, do I have the right number?
Yeah.
They could have done all sorts of things other than just
call the, like,
not.
And
keep following up on
I am assuming that the number that I didn't recognize at work that one time was them. That might not even, like, they can say whatever they like.
I mean, can you search your phone for a particular number?
Yes.
Yeah, you can search the call history, but I don't know how, like, yeah, I can go ahead and pull that up.
And it might be good to check and be able to say, like, yes, you called once, and then stop trying.
Okay, so I put a cardboard on top of this stuff so it's easier to carry out there. But
okay, cool. That's fine.
It's all clearly distinguished.
Great, thank you. Right. Yeah, and if anybody has the energy to put something like that, something like that.
Yeah, I'm not really dressed to go outside at the moment, but I'll do it.
It's actually lovely out.
It is actually quite nice, yeah. Surprising. I was able to turn down the heat in my apartment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was, like, significantly warm when I got in there.
We've been, like, turning it off, turning the main thing off during the day, and then just turning it on again at night, and we didn't turn it on last night.
Okay, when exactly is Thanksgiving? Because they would call after. Well, or can I see the number, and then we can just compare and contrast? So, yep, they called once.
Wait, but the 13th was way before Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay. So there's that, and then since then, nope, nothing.
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 So they did not call you?
Nope.
Unless they called another totally random number.
Right, which is also not something that I would have, like, this is not on us, and they can try what they'd like to make it on us, but it is not. They should have repaired our pipes a fucking month ago.
Right. I mean, it would have been nice if they had gotten to it the first time that they said they were going to do it before it actually started freezing.
Right.
And
maybe we wouldn't have this situation.
It was like, maybe we were too understanding.
That's a theme for us. Which is shitty, because it's like, what we want to do with the world is be understanding and give people compassion and the benefit of the doubt. And then we get fucked! Ah. You're making it really easy, people. You're making it really easy to not want to be nice.
Humans. What is it that I say?
It's community shit would be a whole lot easier if it weren't for the fucking people.
It'd be so fabulous if it weren't for all the fucking people. Yeah,
yeah. Yay!
And I'm sticking to it. And I still need to figure out how to file our taxes this year with the LLC stuff. I need to get on the phone with my person who said he would help me figure that out.
Yeah. So we've already paid the property taxes on the house, right? So then there's property taxes, LLC taxes, personal taxes.
Well, the LLC, if I'm understanding it right, we will take whatever the overall loss is of the LLC and we will distribute it among the three of us.
Oh.
So we will all have a business loss that will offset some of our other tax burden, which would be great because Matt and I just perpetually don't have enough money to pay our taxes when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's almost as though this capitalism thing is terrible, and freelancing is a way to have, like, even more wage slavery than normal, because yes. you're free.
Even extra terribleness.
Yeah. You're free to pay your own taxes.
Yes.
Such wonderful freedoms we have.
Capitalism.
I hate it a lot.
Me too. Let's be friends.
Yay! We are friends.
Yay.
We basically did connect over a hatred of capitalism.
It's true.
That is the basis of our friendship. And then when I came out and y'all were all supportive, that solidified some stuff pretty hard.
Oh, yeah. I just kind of fundamentally don't believe in being dicks to people.
I tried really hard not to. It's becoming increasingly hard as of late, it feels like. But it's a good general policy.
Well, we can still be not dicks, you know?
Yeah.
It would also be good if we were not naive.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it is.
More that.
Mm-hmm. Like, we just have to be stronger about the boundary and, like, when they get violated, be like, okay, so you did a thing that is not okay.
Yeah.
Even when I'm in moments of, like, I really genuinely dislike this person now. They have betrayed and harmed me. When they're actually there, I end up being nice. Whether I like it or not. Like, I don't actually have a very good fuck you
moment. I don't know. Do you think that, like, being nice and not being a dick are the same thing? Because I think you can, like, be not nice and also...
just saying things honestly without... So, yeah.
Right.
Like, I don't know. I sometimes think dickery is needed, though, at this point, because people are not responding to niceness or not responding to even, like, hey, you claimed you called us, but you didn't.
But you didn't.
And
maybe
unless
you
called...
define dickery.
Like, what do we think of as dickery? And is it useful in some places? Or is it something that we need to... fine-tune, like, don't be a dick, but do be clearer about your boundaries and be clear about the fact that it's not okay that you're, like, gonna try and charge us for weekend hours to come out here and fix the pipes that you should have fixed a month ago.
Right. Yeah. That we already paid you half of the money for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep, yep.
Meow. Oh. Yeah.
Oh. Says she really liked our cat song.
Yay!
Yay!
That's nice. I hope she actually got insurance for her child. We went two different times to try and get her. Well, no, the first time we went to Fort Collins and they require some proof of life of the child. Which, I mean, I understand it's a big city and, like, a social security card, you could be doing some fraudulent things and trying to get some child's social security or something.
Right.
So having proof of life of seems reasonable, but she had, like, her daughter's birth certificate and everything on her, so it was, I don't know, whatever. So we went all the way to the social security office, waited for, I don't know, an hour and a half in the frickin' line just to be turned away. And then when we tried to go to Cheyenne to do some other things, to get the proper documentation, I think it was like blizzardy or wasn't feeling well or something, so we couldn't coordinate it, but I'm, that woman works really, really hard.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. She's one of those badass friends of ours.
I was glad to have the time to talk with her in the car, too, because we got to know a bit more about each other and, like, her experiences and, like, how much of a transformation that we've each gone through.
But,
so, that was cool, also.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you need to go be a wage slave?
What time is it? Yeah. Need to go make thousands of calls to people for the so they can hang up on me.
Awesome.
Yeah. Some people are nice about it.
Hanging up on you?
Mm-hmm. They're like, no, thank you. Click. Like,
I try to be nice when I hang up on someone.
Some people know about the secret that
if you tell us, put us on the do not call list or whatever, we have to stop calling you. Mm-hmm. But other than that, if you just hang up, there's nothing that we have to do other than call you back, because that's the disposition that we have in our thing. Like, we're not allowed to not call people if they don't say those
words. Do you, like, have to call them back right away?
No. There's an algorithm in the computer. I don't know exactly what it does, because there's sometimes where I'll call the same number on, like, I'll start calling it at 4, and then 5 will roll around, and I'll call that same number again. Uh-huh. And then 6 will roll around, and I'll call that same number again. Uh-huh. And so it's like a bank of numbers that I'm calling each time, depending on how I code the disposition. It's like whether the person hung up or no answer, if it was a busy signal, if I left a message, all that stuff.
Well, it makes sense that a no answer would be different than a, like, someone hung up on you, you know?
Yeah, and the hung up, like, they normally, that actually used to go to refusal converters, which are the people who, like, would call people who've already refused and see if they could change that, and which it was actually quite successful, but it's a thing that, like, if you refuse, then we'll call you in a week or so or something. It depends on how the sample goes, too, because if we have all new sample, then the people who refuse will take a while to get back to. Uh-huh. If it's all at the very end and we're desperately trying to find, like, 15 more participants or something, then we end up calling the people who've already refused, like, days after they refused, and it mostly just means more yelling.
Yeah, I would find that super annoying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people who used to do that job would get paid more, so, and presumably that's still going to happen. You're just going to get, like, so there's a tiered payment scale or whatever. Sorry to bother you style.
Sorry to bother you style.
Mm-hmm.
I like that that's going to become part of the lexicon.
Yep. Boots Riley's done amazing things, and yeah, I'm excited. I think he's producing another, like, he's working on another movie.
Oh, yeah?
That amazing. That might be false memory, but I'm pretty sure. I just read an article, an interview with him about Sorry to Bother You, and it was talking about, like, Hollywood is often a place of, like, propaganda for capitalism, because it's explicitly that.
Right.
It is very explicitly constructed as a nationalist, like, or a nationalism propaganda machine. And so it's like, how did you get this communist film to be in? It's like, well, I'm a communist, but this isn't actually a film about communism. It's it's a thing about, like, class struggle and leads you to communism. Like, it begs that question.
Right.
But it definitely isn't the same, like, outward propaganda as what Hollywood typically produces.
Right, right.
It's something that is a genuine story that brings in class struggle and makes it very obvious and, yeah, it leads you to ask questions about modes of production and who gets to have control of what, including your life if you join Worry Free. So
it's,
I think,
so
it's really
good. I need to watch it again.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I'd be down for that being something we, like, every 3 months, time to watch some
Sorry
to Bother
You. We should do the weekly watching of
Sorry to Bother You. I would love that. I was saying 3 months.
Is it, like, super surreal since you actually work at a call center?
Yeah. It won, and now since they had the tiered calling system or whatever, and they had in the email.
Wait, are you going to try to become a super caller or whatever they called it?
Oh, I'm a power caller.
You're a power caller.
I am. I'm that tier already.
Mm.
Yeah, I know.
If they try to feed you potions,
I'm going to take it so I can become a horse person and fight better against, because that's awful, awful.
But. Wait, if you're, like, a woman or a non-binary person and you take the thing, do you still get the big horse dick?
I don't know. Because
that was what he, like, sold it to him on, was, like, the big horse dick. You know, not that he bought it, but, you know, that was his selling point.
I actually forgot that point, and I'm curious now, because that actually, like, might be a selling point for me.
Does it also give you, like, the gender switch up so you get the horse dick?
Oh, sex. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe. I'll have to think about it. It would probably ruin my singing voice, though.
Yeah, so, probably.
And that's the reason I'm not taking any hormones.
Mm.
I don't want to affect my singing voice.
Because you have an awesome singing voice.
Aw, thanks.
Yeah.
I like to think so, too. Oh, I need to actually pay attention to things. I will be late to work. Fuck. This is how it happens. This is, I just sit here and think like, I have another 2 minutes. And then 10 minutes pass. I'm like, no, I don't have another 10 minutes. I have negative 18 minutes. Shit. Sorry, people. Okay.
Okay. That didn't actually hurt. I just said ow compulsively.
What are you doing tonight?
I am going to be performing a piece that I've written at The Great Untamed. It's a writer's series that the amazing Charlotte Romero organizes that showcases local writers. So there's Lincoln Humphrey has done a piece, and I believe Lucas Coupala is going to be the next one up after me. And so it is a series of events where people can come and listen to us talk about stuff and read the stuff we've written.
And how are you feeling?
Super fucking nervous. Opened up a snapshot of my day at work, and not just one particular day, but I am talking about stuff that makes people uncomfortable and makes people angry. Love you. Thank you. Meow.
And then, let's have a story about police authoritarianism.
No.
Whee! Here's a snapshot of my day at work. Things happen at work, and they make me feel things. Some of them are good things. Maybe even a lot of them are good things. Some are decidedly not good things. For the sake of what I feel is honesty, I've editorialized a conversation that is in some ways emblematic of what I mean by not good. I've also changed the wording of the survey questions, as well as the respondents' answers, so that nothing is verbatim. In this example, I come up against the realization that I'm complicit in the progression and escalation of police authoritarianism. Other examples I could share would show you ways that I feel complicit in the invalidation of my own existence. I'm required to ask, are you male or female? As well as that of mixed race people. Do you consider yourself more white or more black or African American? Not to mention the fact that I have to use the word, that I'm required to use the term Indian with the descriptor American in front of it most times, as if that makes it more appropriate to refer to Native peoples indigenous to this land that we call the U.S. But I'll try to save those for different stories. Let's start. What is the number of times you have had any experience with Wyoming Highway Patrol? I have answers for none, once, twice, three times, or four or more times. None. Okay, unless you count times at church, said through laughter. Haha, okay. We're still interested in your opinions about the highway cops of Wyoming. And don't worry, your opinions will be given the same weight as anyone who's actually been subjected to interaction with road cops. And in fact, your input will very likely steamroll over the input of people who've actually experienced police brutality. Do you agree or disagree with the next few statements, or are you neutral? I believe the road cops treat people with respect and courtesy. I'll agree! I believe the highway cops respond to situations correctly. I'm an old white woman who's been taught that her opinions are tantamount to absolute truth, so yes, of course. Are there any areas you can think of where the road cops do not meet your expectations? As I stare at the potential options for coding a response that almost never comes because I'm not allowed to offer up the options on this question, and what's there invalidates any attempt at getting at a deeper discussion of systemic violence, police brutality, and the unquenchable thirst for power anyway, given that one of the three options for an answer literally says the cops have an attitude problem, infantilizing the notion behind quotation marks, and the other two options are what happens when cops try to come up with their own flaws. There aren't enough of us. We take too long to come escalate the situation. I preemptively code the response I know she's going to give. Oh no, I think they sure do a great job. Press enter. In which areas would you like to see increased enforcement? I'm required to read a list on this question. Tell me where you'd like to see enforcement increased. It's written in all caps on the survey. The first one I have here is driving under the influence. Increase. Speeding? Oh, definitely increase. Distracted driving? Yes, yes, yes. It didn't sound as sexual as writing out makes it seem, although that might have been the result of some restraint on her part. How about traffic violations by commercial vehicles? Well, you know, we don't really have that problem up here. We just don't have that many trucks or truckers. But yeah, let's do it. Increased enforcement purely for fascism's sake, I always say. This conversation is further highlighted for me by the fact that the preceding interview I've been doing with a much younger person who didn't sound quite so white, honestly, I of course cannot say, but if I were betting envy, I'd wager Hispanic or Latinx, but we never got to that question. It ended when the person tried to, as diplomatically as possible, voice the concern that Highway Patrol needs to exercise discretion. The closest response I could code that to was the attitude option, and I tried to reassure her that her input was valid and worth listening to. I even added a note to the question where I tried to capture as much of the detail as I could in the limited space the survey provides to add a note. Moving on to the next question, left me forced to ask where she'd like to see increased enforcement. Silence. Then beep, 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 beep. Hate that noise. The person who experienced problems with law enforcement ended up not being given a voice in this survey. If you don't complete it, it doesn't count. The person who never dealt with law enforcement and wouldn't be treated unfairly if she did, let's be honest, got to leave them a glowing review. And the second case, the glowing review, is what I get most often, overwhelmingly often. Often enough that I can be assured the Wyoming Highway Patrol is getting exactly what they want out of this survey. They're getting the license they need to wield yet more power over people, and they're using the complicity, civility, and ignorance of privileged white people to do it. Might seem like I'm being hyperbolic. I don't think I am. Because the notion that the same mentality that infantilized the notion of a police attitude problem behind quotation marks is the same mentality that gave Robbie Ramirez's murderer a promotion. I started writing this before Robbie was killed, and I started writing this thinking that Laramie was a small enough community that a cop killing a Latinx man with mental illness for a traffic violation wouldn't be a fucking thing. I thought I was speaking of a brutality that was at least a few years in the making before escalating to the killing that already happened. But that was an assumption based on ignorance, obviously, and I need to sit with that. If I sit with it for very long, it makes me wonder if I can continue to work where I work, which, in unfortunate coincidence, is located in an unfortunately uncomfortably close proximity to the spot where Robbie was shot. I have enough crushing obligation to Capitol, however, that I can't seriously consider quitting, and that seriously makes it considerably worse. You see, I didn't pull the trigger on Robbie, and I know that the Wyoming Highway Patrol and the Albany County Sheriff's Office are separate entities of the same ilk, yet by technical accounts, different. But what's going to happen when the Highway Patrol aggregates the data that was provided to them, predominantly by white people, predominantly by white women, that's who answers the phones for us, older white women, that's who answers the phone for us historically, consult the stats, who seem to be blissfully unaware that their responses are built on bones. Presumably, if they get enough people saying those ruthlessly enthusiastic yeses to increased enforcement, and I'm willing to bet they got a lot of them, they'll increase their enforcement. They'll increase the number of times people get pulled over for speeding, for having their children hollering in the back of the car while they try to change lanes, or whatever else reason that they decide to use as grounds for citing distracted driving, for having out-of-date tags, or headlight out, or driving too slowly. With each endorsement for increased enforcement comes another chance at escalation, or dehumanizing exhibition and humiliation, or execution. That woman who hung up instead of answering a question that enables further police brutality was the one and only time I'd ever coded anything other than the police are doing just fine response. So I guess that means they're doing A-okay. If everybody, if enough people agree, that makes it right. Right? Right? All right. Alt-right. So what the fuck am I supposed to do with this? Seriously, what the fuck am I supposed to do with the reality that a desk job at a call center puts me in a situation where I enable harmful shit? How do I fight it without putting myself in the peril of even more financial insecurity and capitalist precipice than is my current? Is it actually of any use to document the fact that it's happening while not being able to do jack shit about the long-term consequences? I also know this to be the kind of innocuous-seeming, institutionally normalized insidiousness that is exceedingly easy to dismiss, rationalize, and downright protect if challenged. So there is a worry in the more anxiety-ridden spaces of my brain that in articulating these concerns, I open the door to my own undoing. I know stories tend to end with some kind of resolution or some kind of development that resolves in some kind of way, and I don't think that's going to happen here. This is just a big ball of frustration, depression, and dystopian impotent rage that I'm dropping on you so as not to feel the weight of it alone. Maybe so that we can talk about it? Maybe so that we can collectively learn to recognize the true pervasiveness of violent forces that we've been taught to think of as normal? Maybe. Maybe even so that we can use that recognition to understand the patterns of violence we collectively participate in, and to do the real work of disentangling ourselves from oppressive societal systems, finding alternatives to things like, oh, I don't know, police being the first responders to mental health crises, for instance, off the top of my head. And maybe it's because I need to vent about that which is corrupting my soul, or I will explode. And this happens to be the most convenient medium for me. And you, dear listeners, are merely being dragged along for the ride. It's been a ride, and I think we need to get the fuck off the next station.
Weren't we the ones that he modeled a bunch of shit on?
Oh, Hitler? Yeah, to some extent, like, absolutely, in terms of the, like, eugenics programs.
Yeah,
no, you're totally right. And that kind of goes to where I want to end this conversation, sort of the conclusion, but let's start.
I didn't mean to spill your tea.
No, it's actually just water.
I thought he was going to say I didn't mean to spill the beans, but okay. All right, so I start where you want to start
okay.
the conversation.
So this is the first episode, this little pilot of a new recurring segment that I'm going to be doing called Internationalism Now. And I'm Jabron Ludwig. I'm the Solidarity House people. I've been on some of the earlier podcasts, and I'm hoping to take a more active role going forward. I'm currently studying at the University of Wyoming, and I'm working on a human geography degree. My main area of study right now is on like the geography of protests, and particularly the international connections between those protests. We will certainly talk a lot about protests in the future. For now, though, I want to introduce my co-host and mother, Jana Ludwig, here.
Yep, so I'm here, and to some extent, these segments are going to be helping me get better educated as well, so I get to kind of tag along with this and ask questions and support having the conversation go well.
So this segment is going to be about international connections, right? It's not just about international politics or affairs, but the ways in which our world is deeply bound together and why that's important to us as leftists. I think at this point, it's become almost banal to say that we're like in a globalized world. And it's hard to really know what that means. What does it actually mean to be in such an interconnected world? And there are a lot of elements to that. There are political elements, there are cultural elements, and there are economic elements, and they're all very important. So we're not going to get to all that today. For this episode, what I wanted to talk about is the internationalism of the right and some of the kind of strange and also very important trends that have occurred recently. I specifically want to talk about the alliances between Benjamin Netanyahu and some anti-Semitic world leaders like Viktor Orban and Jair Bolsonaro. I want to establish in this episode why we as leftists should care about internationalism. And one of the reasons we should care
is that our political enemies care about aeronationalism. And there are sort of two sides of this. On one hand, you have capitalists, right, who care about aeronationalism because international trade is essential to modern capitalism. And on the other hand, you have the far right, who cares about aeronationalism for its own reasons. And today, I want to dive into the particular right-wing internationalism. And this is kind of a, you know, brief introduction, overview. It's not going to be anything approaching comprehensive, but I wanted to just give like a taste of this and some of the trends that are happening right now. To some extent, in order to start this off, we need to go back to the early 20th century and talk about the proliferation of anti-Semitism throughout Europe. And this is, I promise this will become relevant to today. We'll get around to that. But to begin with, I have one thing that we need to get out of the way, right, is this idea that the Holocaust was something which was perpetrated in Germany by Germans primarily or exclusively. And that's simply not true. Most countries that were conquered by Germany or were allies of Germany during World War II carried out, with varying levels of enthusiasm, parts of the Holocaust. Some countries deported Jewish people en masse, very willingly. Others were forced to at gunpoint. But in almost every case, the Nazis found enthusiastic collaborators. And this is important for a couple of reasons. One, I think it recontextualized the Holocaust as a European crime. This isn't just something that Germany did, although certainly Germany was the main driving engine behind it. But the Nazis were not alone. There were a lot of people throughout Europe who were really eager to participate in this. And that has left marks to this day all over Europe, but particularly in Eastern Europe. And the reason for that is that after World War II, the US wanted to find anti-communist allies in Europe, right? Their main concern after World War II was not fascism, but was communism. And so they sought out reliable allies throughout Europe. And the people who were most reliably anti-communist, almost everywhere, were Nazis or Nazi collaborators or fascists of some other variety. And as a result, denazification happened to an extent, but to a pretty shallow extent. While it's true that a lot of the upper brass got, you know, canned, there were a lot of instances where many people who were deeply involved in the Holocaust and deeply involved in the war effort were not prosecuted and were not removed from their positions. In particular, the Luftwaffe had their headquarters bombed during the war and almost all of the records destroyed. So after the war, when denazification was happening, the US basically just took Luftwaffe officers at face value and they said, oh no, we weren't involved in the Holocaust. But all sorts of evidence has come out since then that they absolutely were and they were just covering their asses. And this is something that happened all over the place. I mean, many people have probably heard of Operation Paperclip, where the US went around Germany finding Nazi scientists and bringing them to the US and basically giving them immunity for their crimes. Most famously, Wernher von Braun, who was the head of the engineering aspect of the US space program, he ran a facility that produced V-2 rockets using slave labor and working people to death for a considerable period in the war. And his crimes were completely ignored, right? Because he was seen as useful to the US. They wanted missile scientists that were better than the Soviet ones. So this trend, though, this occurs all over the place, right? And there's a couple of reasons for this. For one, again, in a lot of places, there was a huge collaborationist element, right? And so it wasn't that hard to find and set up an anti-communist regime out of these collaborationist elements.
So one question that I have is, so why do you think the US was more obsessed with like anti-communism than they were about finding Nazis? Was it just because the Nazis were, I mean, one of the things that I understand about the Nazis is that they were really pretty damn good at science. And was it just a like, well, we're going to ignore this conveniently and put attention on going after these other folks? Was that kind of a smokescreen thing?
So that's a really good question. And also, I do want to dispel one myth there, right? There's this idea that the Nazis were really good at science. And that's not true.
Okay.
There were a couple of areas where Nazis were a bit ahead of the curve in terms of practical engineering, particularly, and this is why Wernher von Braun didn't get executed, as mm-hmm. he probably should have been, is liquid fuel rockets. During the war, and before, other people had developed some liquid fuel rockets, but no one had built anything as stable as like the V-1 rocket, right? No one had built something that could actually be effectively weaponized as a liquid rocket. both the U.S. and USSR used some solid rockets in their weapons. They had some artillery that was that fired like a large number of solid rockets. But the problem is, a solid rocket is very hard to control. So if you basically just want an artillery piece that can fire at long range, that's fine. You don't need something sophisticated. But if you want to send someone into space, if you want to build more sophisticated rockets, liquid fuel is a lot easier to work with.
So it was that little slice of science that the U.S. was really interested in that they were good at. Okay,
And that's true in a couple of other areas too, right? There are some of these practical areas where Nazi Germany was a little bit ahead, but actually in a lot of areas they were pretty behind, especially by the end of the war. There's just a lot of talk about like Nazi jet fighters, but really they were comparable to what was being produced elsewhere at the time. But the Nazis were just so desperate that they were forcing these things into service years before they were really ready, right?
Gotcha.
And so that's where kind of that reputation comes from. Mm-hmm. And the other thing to keep in mind, right, is that a lot of the Nazi troops were very experienced at the time, right? A lot of their fighter pilots had been fighting for 5-6 years, whereas a lot of the Allies people were fresh, particularly the Americans. They just didn't have as much experience. And so they were like getting their asses kicked, but it wasn't because of superior technology. Anyway, that's kind of an aside, but I think it's a pretty common myth. So the bigger part of your question, though, is why did the U.S. and Britain care more about communism? And there are a lot of reasons for this, but for, in the case of Britain in particular, it's because they had a global empire at the time, right? Britain was still a colonial power during and after World War II, and up until the like late 60s, right, they had colonial possessions. And Britain saw communism as the single biggest threat to their colonial empire. Right, far more so than fascism. I mean, in fact, I don't know. I would argue that in a lot of ways, the British had much more in common with fascists than they did with the communists, to be honest. And the U.S. had its own ideological reasons to be afraid of communism, right? I mean, the U.S. has always had this racial and economic underclass, and those are bodies within which very quickly communism can spread. Mm-hmm. And
gosh, I wonder why.
Yeah, And I think another thing to keep in mind, right, is this is a moment in history where people take communism really, really seriously. Like, a lot of people believe that communism is inevitable, that at some point, all of these capitalist countries are going to succumb to communist revolution. It's a matter of time, and it's a matter of playing on the defensive, right? That's their worldview, which is something that seems totally inconceivable to us now, because we live in this post-Cold War era where it's like, oh, well, capitalism is always going to win. That's not how people felt back then. People were, particularly capitalists, were absolutely convinced that communism or socialism was inevitable and they had to fight it. And also, I mean, at the end of the day, right, capitalists, they've never been that opposed to fascists, right? I mean, the U.S. didn't join World War II for moral reasons. It did so for political ones. It was attacked and its ally was attacked, right? It wasn't that the Nazis were so evil that the U.S. had to do this. I think that that's kind of how we tell that story now. But there are a lot of these sort of like little things that keep getting brought up, and for good reason. Like the U.S. famously turned away Jewish refugees who were trying to flee Germany before the Holocaust and sent them back to die in Germany. It was pretty clear that something really bad was happening in Germany mm-hmm. at that time. It wasn't that like everyone knew that death camps were inevitable, but it was really nasty. And we turned them away because at the end of the day, I mean, the U.S. was isolationist. They didn't want immigrants. They didn't want refugees. And this is something we're going to get back to later on, immigrants and refugees. So the whole point of all this is to point out, right, that the right in Europe was intentionally preserved after World War II in a lot of ways. And in ways that I think us in the U.S. are not really aware of, because this didn't happen in our backyards, right? We think of, oh, well, you know, the U.S. occupied all these places and the U.S. fought the Nazis. So presumably the U.S. was still getting rid of the Nazis. But no, not really. In a lot of places, they were actually rehabilitating them. And, you know, they did execute some of them.
Rehabilitating Nazis? What exactly does that mean?
Well, rehabilitating in the sense of rehabilitating reputations. Being like, right, no, this person's like, not that much of a Nazi.
Porter von Braun over here and like...
Exactly.
Like talking up as Mr. Awesomeness. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly what was happening. And this extended to kind of rather bizarre things as well. There was a U.S. operation in the early Cold War to train some Ukrainian Nazis and parachute them back into the USSR in order to start like an insurgency. Luckily for everyone, this plan went terribly, and every single one of them was caught and executed by the Soviet Union. But it just shows right to the lengths to which the U.S. was willing to go.
The U.S. will use Nazis to their own ends, exactly, over and over again.
They're happy to ally with them. And they've got no problem with it. They're much more concerned about allying communists. So to go back a little bit to before World War II, I've got Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism sitting in front of me. It's this like 500-page book. I don't know if I agree with all of it, but it has some really interesting arguments in it. And in particular, the section on anti-Semitism is really compelling. The first third of the book is this essay on anti-Semitism. And her argument is that, in essence, the anti-Semitism of early 20th century Europe, which is certainly not the only version, but that specific version, was premised on the ethno-state, right? The nation-state, and the fact that Jewish people didn't fit into that model in Europe. They had a different language, they had a different culture, they were ethnically, you know, sometimes distinguished more than others, but they seemed different, and they didn't seem to really fit into the nation-state model. And one of the things she points out is that this is not an even process, right? There are places where Jewish communities were very cloistered, and times and places where they were very cloistered, and other times where they were deeply integrated. But particularly at the turn of the century, there was this big embrace of, in particularly post-World War I, the ethnically homogenous nation-state, the ethno-state. And Jewish people did not fit into that, or more accurately, a lot of Europeans didn't think they fit into that, right? This is how they saw that. They viewed them as a sort of international element. They were dangerous. One thing to keep in mind, and this is something she emphasizes again and again, is a lot of Nazi ideology was essentially conspiracy theories, right? Like the classic Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that like complete fabrication, was about this Jewish conspiracy to, you know, run the world. And her argument is that what the Nazis said was, hey, that's not a bad idea. Let's do that instead of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're dangerous because they're doing that. There's this idea in this sort of right-wing ethno-nationalism that Jewish people are this powerful international other that's simultaneously terrifying and more powerful than them, but also weaker and pitiful and, like, disgusting, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you find this in a lot of right-wing thinking. In the U.S., there's simultaneously, throughout our history, this idea of Black people as dangerous and threatening, but also stupid and like weak and just beneath white people, right? Mm-hmm. There's, and I think it's very common. You see this sort of dichotomy that's used particularly on the far right to justify themselves as being defensive, right? There's this idea that, okay, well, Jewish people are trying to run the world, so we should do that just because, you know, otherwise they will. And this plays into this idea that there's this sort of this inevitable conflict. That, right, kind of one of the essential ideas of the ethno-state is that if you have an ethnically homogenous body, what won't happen is that you'll have one group trying to dominate the other. And part of that is it presumes that domination is inevitable. That, mm-hmm, if there are two groups, one of them's going to dominate the other one.
Right, the hierarchy is like natural and good, and the idea is to like learn how to play that game better than anybody else rather than questioning whether that game makes any fucking sense at all.
Exactly. And I think a key thing here, right, is that the people who've really promoted this idea have almost always been people who are already on top of that hierarchy, using it to justify that. They're like, well, the hierarchy is inevitable, so we're not doing anything wrong. We're just preventing these people from dominating, mm-hmm, us.
Mm-hmm. And everybody else just needs to know their place in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they can be wiped out, or they can leave. And so here's where we get to Viktor Orban and Benjamin Netanyahu. So first, I want to talk a little bit about Zionism. And I'm going to be very careful here. There is a tendency to equate Zionism with Jewish people or Judaism, and both of those are completely wrong. Zionism is a fairly modern ideology, late 19th, early 20th century idea that Jewish people should create their own ethno-state or nation-state in Israel, right? Reclaim that land. And so when we're talking about Zionism, we're talking about actually a couple of different ideologies. Some of them they're sort of like more liberal Zionism, more conservative Zionism. And the more right-wing Zionism is much more invested in this idea of the ethno-state. And even if it won't necessarily come out and say it, although it, you know, as the right-wing tends to do, they really do come out and say it a fair bit.
Well, so, and is that an example of, like, so we've been talking about this, like, hierarchy thing and, like, wanting to plug into it and wanting to be sort of the best. And is this an example of, like, the sort of Jewish version of wanting to play that game and, like, wanting to, like, have a place where we can be at the top of that? Is that part of it or not?
So, yeah, that's a really good question. I think there's some of that going on, but I think there's also, like, a genuine defensiveness, right? Mm-hmm.
Like, we need safety, and this is how to create it.
Yeah, like, yeah. And the Holocaust was certainly the worst example of this, but throughout particularly European history, there were a lot of examples of Jewish communities being forced out or killed or just generally treated like shit, like at the best mm-hmm. of times. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty common for a really long time. And that now, right, like, when I say common, it doesn't mean everywhere all the time that was happening, but at any given time in Europe, somewhere... A Jewish community was being treated really badly, and sometimes, you know, they were doing better, they were more integrated. You know, these things are uneven, right? There's not like a universal thing. But and this is really what's important, right? The right-wing Zionist view is that it is universal. It is always the case that Jewish people in diaspora are always vulnerable to this, are always going to be victims of oppression. And to some extent, that might be true, right? Like, a minority in a country, at least, you know, states as we currently have them, are always under threat, right? And they're always, you know, being treated kind of badly. And so, I don't know, on some level, right, there's there's like a sense to this, right? There's mm-hmm. an idea of history that makes sense. Where this, like, idea kind of diverges, right, is it says, okay, it basically accepts that right-wing narrative, right? Again, we're talking here about this sort of right-wing Zionism as embodied by someone like Israel's current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. And it is this idea that in order to protect ourselves from this hierarchy, from this violent domination, we need to carve out our own nation state. And here's kind of the thing, right? Like, the right will say this kind of thing where it's like, well, we just want you to go away. We don't need to dominate you. We just want you to leave. And in that way, like, that's true to some extent. And in fact, even in Israel, right, like, there's this simultaneous desire to kill or remove Palestinians, but also this need for Palestinian labor, right? And this is something you see all over the place. Right-wing governments get trapped between this need to exploit labor and this kind of ideological desire for this pure nation, pure ethno-state. But within sort of the logic of right-wing nationalism, the idea is once you have that pure ethno-state, you don't have that conflict, that the conflict is essentially predicated on these ethnic differences. And this is one of the reasons, right, that the right is fundamentally and inherently opposed to leftism, because the left, we have to understand those ethnic differences, but we also have to understand the ways in which those ethnic differences are unevenly applied across class differences, right? That there are other distinctions within society that also really matter. And for the right, those hierarchies are either justified or they don't really exist. It's either like, well, we're all kind of like fundamentally equal in our like whiteness or in our Germanness. Or it is, well, yes, some of us are even more like superior than others, but that's okay because we're actually all united by our ethnic similarities. Mm-hmm. And these two ideas kind of coexist and compete. Like, what, again, as with everything, right-wing ideology is not homogenous. There is variety there. There are some people who are like believers in kind of an ethnic socialism. I mean, this kind of motto of the Nazis, this like, we're national socialists. I mean, they weren't socialists at all. So we can talk about that at some other time. But the point is that motto was very compelling to people. This idea that we're going to create this socialist utopia for our ethnic group and mm-hmm. no one else because, well, that just doesn't work. That's impractical. Or they're always going to be trying to undermine us or, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. right? There are all these justifications that are given. So moving back to Netanyahu and anti-Semitic world leaders, right? So for Netanyahu and leaders like Viktor Orban, Donald Trump, Jair Bolsonaro, like all these people are really anti-Semitic. And that's fine with Netanyahu because for him, he doesn't want Jewish people in the U.S. He doesn't want them in Brazil or Hungary. He wants them in Israel. There's this opposition between the sort of right-wing Zionist and Jewish people in diaspora. The fact that they are ever safe inherently refutes the need to establish this pure ethno-state. And so the very existence of safe Jewish people in other countries is a threat on some level to their ideology. And so for Netanyahu, if Viktor Orban or Bolsonaro is making Jewish people uncomfortable or feel deeply existentially threatened, that's fine. Like, on one hand, either they'll come to Israel or they will suffer there and be proof that other people should come to Israel. And again, this is kind of bizarre. Now, there's another connection too. And this is
one way to put it.
Yeah, it is kind of bizarre, but you know, that's why I wanted to go in and dive into this conversation about ideology, because without understanding, you know, how right-wing ideology works, it's very hard to understand why that would happen on the surface. What we've described at this point is kind of the ideal right-wing nationalist vision of the world is one where every state is constituted ethnically, and so there are no ethnic tensions everywhere because every ethnicity has their nation state. Even people who would otherwise, you know, hate one another if Benjamin Netanyahu were in the U.S., right, Trump's anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitic elements that he promotes would be threatening to someone like Netanyahu, although, you know, he's wealthy enough that maybe not. But in principle, Jewish people in the U.S. are considerably less safe now than they were 2 or 3 years ago. And that is fine because Jewish people in the U.S. fundamentally violates the shared idea of the ethno-state. And I want to circle back around to something. I want to talk about the other area where these people converge. It's very important. Hatred of Muslims. So this converges with the rehabilitation of Nazis. Recently, Benjamin Netanyahu supported a law in Poland that basically officially rewrote Poland's history so that they, you know, had less complicity in the Holocaust. And the other side of this is that in 2015, Netanyahu said in a speech that it was actually the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who planted the seeds in Adolf Hitler's mind for the final solution, which absolves even Hitler and the Nazis of anti-Semitism and redirects that to Muslims.
And so if folks want to know, you were just reading a line from a Washington Post article.
Yes. This is an article from July of 2018 titled "Anti-Semitism Doesn't Bother Benjamin Netanyahu If It Comes From His Political Allies." So this is a point of convergence for the right, not entirely globally, right, because there's a right wing in the Muslim world too, but around the world, right? You see this in the US, you see this in Europe, in Israel, in India. These are all places where the right has united both internally and externally around being, you know, anti-Muslim for a variety of reasons. And one of them, right, is that Muslim refugees disturb this idea of the ethno-state. And I'm going to talk more about this whole problem, like how did we get here, in another segment. But that's going to wrap it up for today. Do you have any final questions, final thoughts?
No, I just had a lot going through my head thinking about the images of different people being sworn into office and how much people have been freaking out about the people being sworn in on the Quran and that kind of stuff, and just like how it ties in with a bunch of what you're saying. So
yeah,
fascinating. Because that is like it's a disturbance not only of the ethno-state, but like of the power structure that controls the ethno-state that is trying to be created by the right in the U.S. and that it's like so deeply offensive to people that like Muslims are in Congress right now.
Yeah. So the one last thing I wanted to point out here, right, is that the group that's suffering, or that's the target, right, that I think we should really keep in mind, of both people like, you know, Donald Trump, or, I mean, I don't know how ideologically committed he is to anti-Semitism. I think he's, like, perhaps more reflexively anti-Semitic than, like, ideologically deeply so. But he definitely has encouraged some neo-Nazis who, in the U.S., are really anti-Semitic and are willing to kill people for it. And the people who are suffering from both that and the actions of people like Benjamin Netanyahu are Jewish people in diaspora in these countries, right? Unfortunately, they end up getting blamed for a lot of this shit, which is it's totally not okay. Jewish people in diaspora are not responsible for what Israel does. And that's something to keep in mind in all this conversation. This isn't like Jewish people bringing something on themselves. This is a group throwing another group under the bus. And we should really keep that in mind. Don't be anti-Semitic from the left either, please. Also, Israel's an ethno-state, and we need to talk about it. So, yeah. All right. I'll talk to you all next week.
March away, march away, march away. We will.
up and march away, marching all together. Good folks, all a word with you, what a world to bring us to. We shall make the world anew, all of us together. We will up.
Hey everybody, this is Matt. This episode was co-edited by Sarah. We want to welcome Sarah to Solidarity House Cooperative, and we really appreciate her presence and work. So here's the deal. If you like this series, and or if you like everything else that we're doing, covering local, national, and international politics, interviewing people who are actually doing things to build a new economy and a new world, building a communal space here for art, music, and activism, including our original music, and you want to keep us brave and bold and keep us doing these things with the kind of boldness that Scully showed in writing and reading her piece about the police over at the Great Untamed, please support us on Patreon. A $5 a month subscription supports us and gets you tons of original bonus content too. It supports several different podcast series, Solidarity House, Solidarity Wyoming, Cowboys on the Commons, and even more series, and gives you a lot of bonus content as well. We're at patreon.com/solidarityhouse. Please become a subscriber today. You're paying about $1 an episode if you do, and thank you so much for listening.
As we go, comrades all together, we will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together. We will up and march away, march away, march away. We will up and march away, marching all together.